Bitcoin prices have steadied a little after getting routed earlier in the week following the crypto's rollout in El Salvador. But given some fresh negative sentiment in the crypto space, that steadiness may prove fleeting. Let's dive in here with Bobby Ong. He's the co-founder and COO of CoinGecko. Bobby, good to see you here. Look, so the price action has steadied. That's good for crypto fans. What do you sense could be next? Is there another shoe to drop in terms of prices here?
Sure, it's very hard to predict what's coming next in the crypto price. But I mean, a couple of days ago, Bitcoin dropped 17% from roughly $52,000 to $42,000. It's recovered a little bit since then. This came on the back of El Salvador adopting Bitcoin as legal tender. There were some technical challenges with regards to its rollout, but this really wasn't the main reason for the correction. The crypto market has been on a rise since late July, with Bitcoin going up 70% from its 30K levels. And many traders were looking for a point to take profits, and large sell orders resulted in the spot market, futures market liquidating over-leveraged traders, causing a flash crash. I think if you look at the funding rates for Bitcoin perpetuals, Bitcoin futures, yes, turned positive in the days leading up to the correction, signifying that traders have become over-leveraged and have largely gained back the confidence lost in the large drawdown in May, where Bitcoin went from 64K to 28K in a matter of weeks. The funding rates at this point in time is still slightly negative, so it doesn't seem that the traders are very bullish yet. So I think my guess is it's just probably going to chop for a bit more. We don't know if it's going to go up or down at this point in time. I would say that the market correction was perfectly normal scenario, and this is very common in crypto to have sort of like 20% drawdowns, and that's taken place multiple times in the history of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Bobby, we had a guest on yesterday push back on this notion that there's a lot of leverage in the crypto space. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I hold a view that there is a lot of leverage in the crypto space, though this has sort of gone down over the years, I would say. So you have offshore crypto exchanges offering up to 100x leverage for you to trade on the futures market. So this was very common with BitMEX, with FTX, with Binance Futures, and so on. But recently, I think regulators have cracked down massively on all these offshore crypto exchanges. So the leverage levels have dropped. Binance and FTX have both announced that they are reducing the leverage offered to crypto traders. But there are other alternatives out there in the market, like exchanges such as Bybit, that users can sort of gravitate to kind of trade with high leverage. So there is a lot of leverage used in the market, and the funding rates are usually one of the methods which we use to track how much leverage there is in the market.
Hey, Bobby, it's Julie here. When we're looking at this sort of adoption that's happening around the globe, places like El Salvador, Ukraine now formally putting some regulation around the trading of Bitcoin and allowing it, which it didn't before, do you see that more as a risk or a potential upside for crypto when you're looking at government intervention of various kinds?
I certainly view this positively. Ukraine and El Salvador adopting Bitcoin as a legal tender is definitely a big win for crypto. Ukraine adopting Bitcoin is also a big news. I think governments worldwide are starting to see that Bitcoin and blockchain technology, they're not here to disappear. They won't disappear anymore. They're here to stay. You can't put a genie back into the bottle once it's out. And countries are starting to realize that if you can't ignore it, it's probably best to try to put in place favorable regulations to encourage investment in this sector and to tax this growth area appropriately. What I would say is I think I would expect a lot more countries to legalize cryptocurrencies. Most will not take the extreme steps like El Salvador to make it legal tender. El Salvador, I think, is a unique case because the economy is a dollarized economy in the first place. So they don't really have much to lose in the sense they are effectively making a bet that things may pan out well by swapping one foreign currency, which in their case was US dollar, to another foreign currency, in this case, Bitcoin. Things may or may not work out, in which case, if things do not work out, they can always move back to the US dollar. And if things do work out, then it could be a very interesting case study. And I'm sure a lot of their neighbors are watching the economic experiment that is happening in El Salvador.
Yes, I'm sure that they are. Speaking of economic experiments, you know, what's been catching my eye recently is the huge market cap increases in some of the once obscure coins. And it's happening really quickly. You know, I'm looking at our list of cryptocurrencies on our site, And, you know, yes, you have Bitcoin and Ethereum up there. Cardano is now one of the biggest coins, right? You've got Solana on there as well, which kind of came out of nowhere as well. Hexcoin, whatever that is, although that's a smaller market cap, is on there as well. But, you know, so some of the ones that have really gained in size and coming from nowhere, I mean, how much do people need to be aware of those and how much do people need to be careful of those?
So yeah, I mean, among the list that you mentioned, maybe not everyone, not all these coins are legit. I mean, there's a lot of scam tokens out there in the market. But I think what's interesting is a lot of these tokens, the coins, they have sort of crafted a niche in the space. No doubt many are sort of created just for speculation, but some of them have interesting use cases. So like Bitcoin's sort of gone on this store value narrative. So it becomes like a coin because it's got a fixed supply. It supposedly parallels has it draws parallels to digital gold. Ethereum goes around the narrative of it being a decentralized world computer. And because Ethereum has a pretty fixed capacity on its network, resulting in high gas fees, this has sort of spurred the growth of other competitors. And one of the other competitors would be Solana. And the main things driving the growth of Ethereum would be things like the decentralized finance applications, things that are building exchanges in a decentralized manner and all the lending platforms in a decentralized manner and so on. Also, NFTs are a big driver for taking up the block space in Ethereum. So if you look at Solana, because Ethereum is full and the gas fees and the transaction fees are really high on really expensive on Ethereum, a lot of people have sort of moved on to all the alternative blockchains like Solana. So Solana has sort of grown 10x in a matter of months, and from $20 to up to $200. And I think there's a lot of growth. I mean, if you look at the amount of money locked in the smart contracts on Ethereum, on Solana, on Polygon, and so on, we've seen like more than 8x growth in the total value locked. So early in January 2021, like $20 billion worth of cryptocurrencies or tokens of value are locked in contracts. But now it's over $170 billion in total value locked in terms of amount of cryptocurrencies locked in the smart contracts. So I think there's a lot of strong growth. I sort of view the world that all these financial applications that are built in a traditional manner will sort of be migrated over to the blockchain to be placed in decentralized finance applications. And on a broader level, I view the world that a lot of these Web2 applications, things that are built in a centralized manner, will be moving on to the Web3 applications, things that are built on the blockchain in the coming years.
I really appreciate these insights. Bobby Ong, co-founder and COO of CoinGecko. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. You too.
I think Brian Sozzi put it well yesterday when he said, we're in a weird place in the markets, in where we're trying to figure out where the economy is going. Is that okay if I quote you, Brian Sozzi?
I love it. Go write the article too. Excellent. Please get it out there.
So I want to bring in someone else to give her perspective on this, and that's Erin Brown. She is a portfolio manager at PIMCO. Erin, it's good to see you again. And I think Brian said that, if I can paraphrase him, you know, because we are looking at the Delta variant and its effect on the economy. We hear the ECB today saying they're going to be shrinking their bond purchases as we await similar news from the Fed. We've got a lot of forecasts out from Wall Street strategists, and there's a pretty wide range in what they're expecting. So when you look at these markets, how do you put all that together and figure out how to trade it?
I think we're in a transition spot right now in the economy, as well as in broader markets, where we're transitioning from a very early cycle environment in which growth was supercharged coming out of the recession of last year, and in which markets were really, you know, driven by beta coming out of this very early cycle environment. And now, as we start to move into more of a mid-cycle environment, it does get a little bit trickier. We do expect that returns are going to be lower, certainly, than what we've seen over the last 12 months or so, but we're still in a very good spot in the economy. And I think we're still in a good spot in terms of corporate profitability and the outlook for it. So while I think you're going to see less supercharged moves to the upside, I do think you're going to see a more gradual continued appreciation of the market, albeit with a little bit higher volatility.
Aaron, perhaps you could break this down for us. So you have the ECB now saying it will scale back its bond buying. Potentially, the Fed could be in the same position before year end. Those are two powerful developments that have not been the norm in markets. What do you think will be the impact to bond and equity markets as these two things are happening at the same time?
So listening to the ECB today, I think it was really key. Firstly, it was largely in line with expectations in terms of their announcement of a gradual tapering of the PEP program. But I think what was important was that it's going to be modest, and they're still likely to remain engaged in buying for a very long time. And that's going to continue to support risk asset markets. In addition to that, it looks like they're going to be behind the Fed, certainly, as well as the Bank of England in terms of rate hikes. Right now, the market's not pricing in anything in terms of rate hikes until December 2023. And even at that, it's about 10 basis points. So a very gradual return to more normal markets with respect to the ECB's bond buying program. Similarly with the Fed, while the Fed is likely at the upcoming meeting to pre-announce the announcement of the start of tapering, they're likely going to do so only very gradually. And we're not anticipating that they're actually going to start tapering until January of next year. And with that, we expect it's going to take at least 6 to 9 months for them to end their bond buying program, after which we expect that in the midpoint of 2023, they'll start raising rates for the first time. So again, we're going to be in this prolonged period of central bank involvement on a global basis, and that's going to be continually supportive for risk assets. Keep in mind, real rates in the US are still about negative 1%. That's a very, very benign environment for risk assets.
And, you know, maybe a benign environment or a conducive environment for inflation to continue to grow too, Aaron. You know, on a micro basis, at least, we're hearing so many companies still talk about raising prices and talk about supply shortages. Could we be in a more sustained, even 3% inflation world? And what effect is that going to have on equities?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the question whether or not inflation is transitory is something that, you know, certainly is central to the market conversation right now. We still believe that inflation is transitory. And if you dig in and look at what the predominant drivers of inflation have been over the last 6 to 12 months, it's largely been driven by these one-off price increases, which once they sort of settle are likely not to persist, where we'll continue to see increased prices, you know, over time. So as an example, one of the predominant drivers of inflation over the last, at least year to date has been new and used car prices. And that's because, as you noted, it's been very difficult to source some of the raw materials that go into cars, and particularly to source semiconductor chips from Asia, largely because of supply chain shortages being driven by the pandemic. That is something that we would see as a one-off price increase. But we don't expect that you're going to see an upward spiral of continued price increases, particularly as supply chains normalize coming out of the recession. So we do expect that inflation will remain high this year in the mid 4% at year end, but will likely decrease to about 2.3% at year end 2022. And so we are going to see a more normalized inflation environment, particularly as we move through the back half of next year. And so we do think that the Fed is viewing these price increases as transitory and likely won't react too aggressively in response to what they see as a transitory impact.
Have you made any changes to your portfolios this month so far?
This month, we've been gradually starting to look at some of the more industrial sectors, some of the more cyclical sectors in the economy that have underperformed over the last 3 months or so, but we think are likely to start performing well, particularly as we, you know, exit this heightened period of concern regarding the Delta variant. So both on the industrial side, as well as on the leisure and hospitality side, we do think that you will see more normalization, and that's likely to, you know, augur well for some of the more cyclical sectors. We had transitioned our portfolio to a much more defensive orientation about 3 months ago, buying the tech sector again, which, you know, turned out to be well-timed. But we think now we're going to see, particularly into the fourth quarter push, a return to more cyclicality in portfolios.
Interesting. Aaron, it's good to see you. Aaron Brown is a portfolio manager at PIMCO. Thanks for being up bright and early for us this morning, although I know you're up anyway, but still, on camera is a different animal. Thanks so much, Aaron. Appreciate it. It's time for our FA Corner, where we talk to different financial advisors, find out what you need to know about finding a financial advisor and different aspects of managing your money. We're joined by Luis Strohmeier of Octavia Advisors today. And Luis, I want to kind of take it back to basics here, first of all, which is when people are first looking for a financial advisor, what they need to know. You know, there are sort of different types of advisors, and I'm sure there are certain criteria that people need to look for. What do you tell people when they're beginning this search?
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Brian. First of all, great question. There is so many advisors to choose from. I think last count over 400,000 advisors just in the U.S. And I think the most important thing is to classify them for clients and the consumer to kind of look at the differences. So you have advisors that are captive. Those are people that are common law employees. They work for a big outfit, a big bank. It could be a Merrill Lynch. It could be a J.P. Morgan. It could be any of those companies that hire and have employees to serve as advisors. Then you have the hybrid advisor. That is a semi-independent, is an advisor that works for an employer but has the freedom to look for services and products outside of the manufacturer. And then you have the independent advisor. The independent advisor is someone that certainly does not work for anyone other than the client and is a fiduciary for the most part. And that advisor basically has an open architecture to work with that client and has a duty to the client versus an employer.
And Luis, when people are looking at these different, now that they understand these different types of advisors, I believe you're an independent advisor, if I've got that right. And what are the different advantages of those different types?
Yeah, I think as an independent, the main thing is transparency. And SEC is very clear about being a fiduciary, and you must disclose all conflicts of interest. You must disclose compensation. You must disclose everything that there is to be known about the relationship. So clients need to have a clear vision of what that relationship entails and what is being covered under that relationship. Another thing is that I believe is important is credentials. What does that advisor have to be an expert in that field? Is that advisor working in that field for many years and understands the nuances of that field to help that client? Whether that is estate planning, whether it's asset management, whether it's divorce, whether it's retirement, whatever the case may be, you want that advisor to be well-educated, having been in that field for many years and be able to understand that client.
Luis, and certainly. I was just going to ask, you know, market dynamics are starting to change. You have growth slowing down. You have the Federal Reserve potentially getting ready to shift its stance on how it views bond purchases. What questions should clients be asking of their financial advisors right now?
I think, you know, the economic stance right now with the tapering, as you're mentioning, and where the Fed is going to go, I think what I'd be most concerned is, am I able to retire or carry on the same things that I've been planning? I mean, we're coming off 2 years of a great market upbeat. What's going to happen? It can't last forever. Eventually, we will have a turndown. Am I ready for that? What do I need to do to be on track if that happens? I think it's important for clients to have a pulse with their financial planning. And I think measuring that pulse every 6 months, I think is fairly adequate.
Yes, especially right now, and given everything that is changing so quickly. Luis, thank you so much for walking us through these important issues for investors. Luis Strohmeier of Octavia Advisors, appreciate your time this morning.
But let's turn our attention to one of the headlines a lot of investors are watching, and that is GameStop. You see it going down nearly 7% in the session. GameStop's losses narrowed in the most recent quarter, but that's done little to stem the bleeding on the stock. The company failed to provide an outlook, and executives also refused to take questions during the earnings call, and you see their performance in the most recent quarter. Let's bring in Michael Pachter, Wedbush Securities equity research analyst. Michael, we always love talking to you about GameStop. I know you've got strong opinions on the company, but let's try to push this forward looking. The losses did narrow. That seems to point to a good sign for where the company is going. Why do you think the stock's sliding today?
You know, I've been street high with my earnings estimate for at least a couple of years. It was clear when we saw new consoles launch in the fall of 20 that we were going to get a big boost in sales for GameStop. And it was equally clear that old management was going to cut back the number of stores. New management's continuing to do that. So they're really well positioned to be profitable. I have them making $1.40 in 2023. So I think that's probably about right. And, you know, they have $23 in cash. So a reasonable multiple on that gets you to around a $50 price target. The stock's trading at a multiple of that. So investors somehow either believe that they're going to more than double their sales, and I don't know where that growth's going to come from, or they're going to quadruple their operating margin, and I don't know how anybody believes that GameStop's going to be the best retailer on the planet generating 10% operating margins. So, you know, there's a lot of faith in Ryan Cohen, and he's obviously accomplished a lot. He's picked a really good management team, and maybe there's a strategy there, but, you know, if they told us the strategy, they'd have to kill us. So I think investors are selling off the stock today because they promised this strategy back in January, and this is the third consecutive earnings call that they failed to deliver one. So we don't really know what it is. I'm beginning to suspect there isn't one. The, you know, strategy is be like Amazon, and God bless them. I hope they make it.
Be careful what you're saying here, Mr. Pachter. You're going to have the Reddit crowd coming after you, but I think it's fair. It's a fair criticism. You know, it's been a while, and I'm not going to say that there's not a fundamental case here around GameStop, because I also wouldn't want to make that crowd angry, but we have seen volatility here kind of, you know, it swings almost crazily, and so, I mean, it does kind of indicate that there's more than just fundamentals, because we don't learn that much on a day-to-day basis to kind of justify that volatility. We also heard from AMC almost simultaneously here talking about a potential partnership with GameStop. And I know you've been critical about a lot of these maybe marketing moves before when it comes to kind of valuing these stocks. I mean, what do you make of that, and whether there's any real meat to that?
Well, first of all, props to Adam Aron. I think he's an excellent CEO at AMC. I think he is really enlightened by capitalizing on the retail investor interest. And I think he's been refreshingly candid, telling them he's going to sell stock. But he's managed to sell into this strength and help his balance sheet quite a bit. I laughed when I saw that headline, because I'm old enough to remember back in 2008 when Blockbuster reached out and made an unsolicited bid for Circuit City for $1.3 billion. And I remember being on Jim Cramer's show saying, you know, it was like the Titanic merging with the Hindenburg. I don't think that AMC and GameStop are in as bad a shape as the Titanic and the Hindenburg, but it's funny to see, you know, two slow growth or no growth retailers trying to get together and find some commonality. And I doubt it will go anywhere. And frankly, I think Ryan Cohen is confident enough that he doesn't think he needs anybody else to help him with the strategy. So I don't see that going anywhere, but it did make me laugh.
Michael, when you think about the performance of GameStop, obviously off of the highs that we saw in January at the height of the meme trade, but it's still at $184 a share. And I know you've got pretty low. You had a pretty low target the last time we spoke to you. How much lower do you think it goes? And it's really about, like you said, that the company is just not offered a strategy for moving forward and pushing growth beyond what it has been, which is stagnant.
Well, you know, my $50 target applies a Best Buy multiple. And Best Buy right now is best in class of kind of slow growth, no growth retailers. You know, nobody thinks Best Buy is going to dominate and take over from Amazon, but they're definitely doing a great job of, you know, with a really strong service offering. And it trades at about a 19 multiple plus cash. So I apply that to GameStop, I get to $50. You could convince me that Ryan Cohen was going to double earnings and I could maybe get to 85. You know, triple earnings, I could get to 120, but I just can't get up here. I don't know how he's going to generate $10 a share in earnings to justify $185 share price. So it's not happening. And again, maybe he'll surprise me. He'll give us a strategy. He won't have to kill us. And it'll be brilliant. And we'll say, my God, they're going to take over the world. Great. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I feel like we're the farther and farther along this goes, you do want to start to hear some details in terms of those plans. And as we're seeing here with shares under pressure, maybe the time's running short. But Michael Pachter, Wedbush Securities Equity Research Analyst, always love having you on. As Akiko said, got to come back soon. Be well, sir.
Shift our attention to the game now with one of the NFL greats. We've got Joe Theismann. He is former NFL MVP as well as Super Bowl champion. Joe, we should point out it is your birthday today. So let's start by wishing you a happy birthday. A good way to kick off, right? A good way to celebrate here.
What a great birthday present to have the NFL season kick off tonight with the Cowboys and the Bucks. And also, I might add this, it's my son Joe's birthday as well. So we share a birthday together, and it's exciting, it's fun, and it's exciting to be able to sit and watch football tonight. We've heard so much rhetoric about so many different aspects of life and the games. Now we're going to get a chance to really watch some football, which is going to be exciting and fun.
Yeah, I mean, celebrations all around here, but something tells me that you've got a big favorite in this Cowboys and Bucks matchup. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think Tampa Bay's defense is just one of the best in the league. And you know, I hope Dak is healthy. I hope he gets through everything healthy. But I've tried to recover from a broken leg, and I had shoulder problems, and he hasn't had a lot of practice time. I really feel like the key to this football game tonight is the offensive line of the Dallas Cowboys and Ezekiel Elliott's ability to run the football against Tampa Bay so that Dak doesn't have to drop back 50, 55 times. But, you know, and of course, how can you not root for Tom Brady one more time? It's funny, with all the success that Tom has had, there are those people out there that just say they're so sick and tired of seeing Tom at the top of the mountain and Tom at the top of his game and all this other stuff. My whole feeling about that is if you don't want him there, knock him off the pedestal. And no one's been able to do it. So he sits atop of our league as, I think, the best player in the league, the best quarterback certainly of all time. And it'll be fun to watch him in his 44th year. I don't believe he's from this earth, to be perfectly honest with you. I think he's been beamed down here just to give us an idea of what might be where SpaceX is going and everything else. So there might be something else out there. There might be more Tom Brady somewhere out there. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I hope nobody knocks him off from that shelf. He's on my fantasy team this year, so fingers crossed. But Joe, I mean, I know you've been busy. You've been working with medical cost company Medliminal. We talked about them last time, and it is kind of at the heart of one of the issues. Obviously, the NFL has been pretty strict about vaccines for players and trying to control that. You know well, through working with them, I'm sure, the costs associated with COVID. So, I mean, how are you looking at maybe how the NFL has pushed that? You mentioned Dak. He's been kind of at the forefront of not wanting to really reveal much about his vaccine status. I mean, what's your take maybe on how it could be a liability for some teams out there?
I think there's a possibility it could. COVID certainly looms as a big cloud over the NFL. You're not going to be sure exactly what's going to happen to teams. It'll certainly affect the betting, which we were talking about before, about how many sponsors now have jumped in. I think one of the things the NFL did last year during the pandemic was they increased the practice squad to 16 players, and they have what's basically a PUP rule, which is PUP. If you're allowed to bring players up to your team if somebody's not available twice, but the second time they come up, they have to remain on the roster, so you'd have to release someone else. So they created some flexibility in this rule and gave you a pool of players to be able to bring people in so that the quality of the game can remain the same. And that's a big thing. I think you'd hate to see somebody lose three defensive backs and then all of a sudden try and play a team that throws the ball around 40 or 50 times. You know, you're going to play the Kansas City Chiefs and all of a sudden you've lost three defensive backs. It would certainly be a challenge. So in an effort to remain with parity in an effort to try and keep the playing field as level as possible, I think the NFL made a very wise decision, and it's carried over into this year as well. And so that's from a medical standpoint. And you're right, I've been involved with Medliminal now for over 3 years. And what we basically do is we look at businesses and we look at the expenses that they have regarding healthcare, and we try and help them manage through it, because there isn't anybody out here, I believe, that's listening. Maybe a doctor or somebody in the medical profession itself can understand what is on a medical bill. And this is what Medliminal does. And it's very easily spelled. It's Medliminal. And you can go to medliminal.com and look at what we do. And we basically, you know, look for inaccuracies in the medical bills and make mm-hmm. sure that you're paying what you're supposed to be paying.
To what extent, though, Joe, you know, working with these companies, have you seen the investments shift as well as the attention to medical care? I mean, we've talked so much about the benefits and the priorities being shifted as a result of the pandemic. What specifically have you seen from the business side?
Well, what you've been able to do is if you can. Costs are always very important when you look at a company. What are they spending on healthcare? What are they spending on advertising? What are they spending on marketing? You look at these costs, and the area of healthcare is one where if you have someone that can look at a bill and say, well, this isn't quite as accurate as it should be. There is a percentage here that you're losing because of the inaccuracies of the bill itself. It's a chance to be able to recoup some money. And so obviously there isn't a company out there that doesn't want to try and save money. And in this environment where we're now finally starting to see the workforce increase because of the payments from the government stopping, so people basically have to go back to work. So you're going to have more people out there working. You're going to need more eyes on it. So, you know, I guess you could consider Medliminal like a big brother, sort of looking over your shoulder, making sure that this is one aspect that we can handle from a business standpoint that can save you money.
Yeah, and out of all those companies out there who have been nervous about losing more money, it kind of explains why the NFL has been pushing its players to get vaccinated and really stepping up the penalties there, because they don't want to see money lost on those games. But, Joe, I mean, to turn back to the game itself here, and particularly some news about your Washington football team there, as a Washington great, you know, we got the list of names here. There's about eight, they say, that it's whittled down to. You got Armada, Presidents, Brigade, Red Hawks, Commanders, Red Wolves, Defenders, and, of course, Washington football team still. You're the greatest Washington player I think I can ever remember here. So talk to me about which one you'd throw your support behind.
You're very kind. You realize this is a political environment, and I live in the Washington, D.C. area. So I have to play politics here a little bit. I really don't know what the name is going to be. I have no preference. That's above my pay grade when it comes to the decision. I would like the decision made as quickly as they possibly can. And keeping in mind, just as an example, it took the Rams 2 years to be able to get their logo approved on their helmet. So how much goes into securing a name? How much goes into changing a name? All the things you have to be conscious of, the suits that might possibly come. These are all things that the team has to go through that fans don't understand. They just think it's a light switch. We want a name, let's flip a name, let's put it on. There's a lot more to it. And so from my perspective, whatever we become, I think that this young group of football players on the Washington football team will have a chance to establish their own legacy going forward under whatever name or whatever logo they're going to have. But it's an exciting young group, one of the youngest teams in football, led by one of the oldest quarterbacks in football. I think next to Tom, Fitz is right up there with Ben and a few of the others. Of course, you know, this being the 9th of September and Fitz is in the 9th team that he's on, maybe it's just an omen that this is going to be a special year for Washington.
And finally, Joe, we have to put you on the hot seat before we let you go. 5 months out from the Super Bowl, never too early to start talking about it. What's the pick? What's your pick?
Oh, goodness. I've avoided this question 5 times already today. Not to mention all of everybody that's wished me happy birthday and said, oh, by the way, who do you think is going to be in the Super Bowl? I still believe that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers defensively dominate. I believe defense wins championships. So I wouldn't count out the Green Bay Packers. They've been knocking on the door twice. I still like Tampa Bay. And on the AFC side, I just think it's the Buffalo Bills' time to be able to rise to the occasion. Once again, I will qualify my predictions with, we don't know what COVID will do to teams, and we don't know what injuries will do to teams down the stretch. But right now I'm looking at Tampa Bay and Buffalo, and everybody else, don't get mad at me. It's just something early in the season.
You're going to start getting calls, but you're right. COVID, the big unknown. I mean, Tom Brady at 44 years old, I think at that point, even those who have not supported him throughout his career, they'd be rooting for him too. But Joe, it's always good to talk to you. Hope to have you back on the show again soon.
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate it. And thank you for the birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Norfolk State University is giving cold, hard cash to vaccinated students and staff. Joining me now is the president of Norfolk State University, Dr. Juvan Adams-Gaston. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us. I have a feeling yours is going to be the first of many universities to do this. Tell us what exactly you're offering to students and faculty who are vaccinated.
Thank you so much, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. This is a one-time gesture to help our community stay healthy. And so what we're really doing is a recognition of the support that our community is giving to ensure that we are well, that we're healthy, and that we're vaccinated.
So students are going to receive how much? $500, I believe, and what about staff?
Students will receive $500, which will actually be an opportunity for them to actually get the dollars, not on their account. And the faculty and staff will get $1,000, which will be in their payroll. So everyone should be vaccinated by September 20th. And then that allows for them to be recognized and have the opportunity to receive either the $500 as a student or the $1,000 as a faculty or staff. We want our entire community included because we know how difficult this pandemic has been for our community. So we want to recognize that, and we want to have the opportunity for individuals to take care of their families in really meaningful ways.
How large is the student body there at your university?
We run between about 5,300 and 5,600 students.
And how many of those do you know? How many of those have been vaccinated?
So we're still in, we still have the soft data, and tomorrow we will have the hard data. But I can tell you, we are right around 90% of students who are coming to campus or on campus vaccinated. So we're really, really pleased that we have such a good response. And I will tell you, once students heard about the recognition, those numbers went up quickly.
They did. So once they knew they were going to get some money, more people ran out to get the shot. That's great. So it's doing what it was intended to do. But to be clear, are you mandating that students and faculty get vaccinated, or is it still optional?
So we are in keeping with what our Governor Northam has done, which has mandated that all public employees be vaccinated. So we are requiring that all students, faculty, and staff be vaccinated unless they have waivers for either religious reasons or for health reasons.
Okay, so are you finding that, what happens if a student or faculty member is not vaccinated and they don't have those exemptions? Can they not come to work? Can they not come to class?
They will, if they have the waiver, they can come to the campus, but they will be tested often. So twice, maybe up to three times a week, they will be tested.
And are you finding pushback, or what are some of the arguments folks are making for not getting vaccinated at this point?
The biggest issues that we've had are, you know, the safety of the vaccine and not knowing much about the vaccine. And what we remind them of is that we're following the science, and the science tells us that the vaccine is safe, that it is effective, and that we stand a much better chance as an institution if we vaccinate our community.
How are things there, though, in the state of Virginia right now? I know we had the governor of West Virginia on many months ago, and they were trying to entice people by handing out some money to folks. That worked for a little while, but it seems as though things are going backwards, at least in that part of the state. How are things where you are right now, Doctor?
So where we are right now, we're looking at community, the what we call the Hampton Roads community, that's working very hard to ensure that more people get vaccinated. So when we're running at the university, probably around 89-90%, hopefully when we finish all the numbers of students vaccinated, that makes us a leader. And as such, and we should be, and as such, we can go out to the community, because for us, our community is not just within the walls of the university, but outside the walls. And we can talk to people about how to more effectively meet the challenges of COVID. And you have to remember that particularly, we're historically Black college university. So you have to remember that in the Black and Brown community, COVID was disproportionately impacting and causing deaths in our community. So we're really engaged in thinking through and working through how to make sure the community can be more safe.
All right. Well, best of luck with your efforts there at Norfolk State University. Dr. Javon Adams-Gaston, president of that university, thanks so much for being with us today.
But why take it from me? Let's bring in the gentleman who joins us usually around earnings, but is joining us about a month in advance, Lance Fritz, the CEO from Union Pacific and president. It's good to have you here, Lance. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for hosting us. And you mentioned the second quarter. It was a heck of a second quarter, and we're in pretty good shape in the third quarter as well.
So let's start generically, because you are a bellwether for this economy. You see what's going on in shipping. And in that second quarter, bulk commodity revenue was up 19% year over year, grain shipments up 12%. The one thing we talked about, and I remember when we did the earnings call with you, when you came on the show in July, we talked about the fact that automotive, it was up 119%, even with the shortages with semiconductors. Where do we stand now as we're just about to finish this third quarter?
Yes. So what we see is in the rail industry, for us specifically, the heat, the very top side of volume has kind of calmed down a little bit. We think the underlying economy is still very strong. Consumers are sitting on a lot of cash. We think the automobile industry, absent the chip shortage, sees fundamentally strong underlying demand. The housing market continues to see pretty strong fundamental demand. So it looks like a little bit of the heat, the top side of the economy is cooled off just a touch, but it's hard to say that anything but a really strong underlying foundation still exists.
In the last quarter, your freight car velocity declined roughly 6%, but your train length, the average train length, was up 9%. As you're going in through this quarter, what are you seeing that you can share with us? And how should we, as investors looking at, you know, trying to determine what it means, what does it mean?
Adam, when the network's really running well, what our investors, what all of our stakeholders should see is a really nice, strong car velocity, something north of 220 miles a day. They should see car dwell, which is the amount of time freight cars sit in yards, at about 22 hours, give or take. They should see our locomotive productivity be 140-ish, plus or minus, and they should see our workforce productivity be north of 1,000 in that measure. When all of those things are working well, that indicates that the overall network is in really great shape. What we've seen here in the third quarter is that we've had a couple of headwinds, mostly driven by Mother Nature. On the West Coast, we had our I-5 corridor impacted by the lava fire and the Dixie fire, and then we had Hurricane Ida, as well as some monsoon flooding impact us on the southern tier. We're in the process of digging out of that. Our current network is agile and robust and operates well enough to be able to recover relatively quickly. We're laser focused on that. And I anticipate by the end of the third quarter, going into the fourth, we'll be back to demonstrating the kind of performance level that we did early in the second quarter and as we entered into the 2021.
One of the things we talk about every time you join us during earnings is the operating ratio. And the last time it was 55.1%, an incredibly efficient railroad. Are the things you just mentioned going to impact that? Because investors look at that when they're making decisions about whether to buy or sell.
Yeah, our guidance for the year, coming into the year, was, you know, 6%-ish growth on the top line. We said 500 million-ish in productivity, and 150 to 200 basis points of operating ratio improvement. We modified that in the second quarter to say we think there's 7% or so volume potential. We think the $500 million of productivity is hard to get, but it's still there. And we think that we're going to be more like a 200 basis point improvement in our operating ratio. We're sticking with all of that guidance. It's getting harder on the top line, given the impacts that we're seeing and a little bit of slowdown that we're seeing on the top line growth. We think productivity is going to be harder to come by because of some of the things that we've had to do in order to overcome the impacts of Mother Nature. But we still are very confident we're going to be able to get that 200 basis point improvement in our efficiency.
You also have to deal with the Biden administration's executive order on infrastructure. And this goes to something in the railroad industry called reciprocal switching. Here's how the Wall Street Journal described it: the practice in which railroads can be compelled to share access to their tracks with competitors. There's a huge switching yard. It's not part of your system. In Elkhart, Indiana, I used to drive by it all the time on my way to work at WSJV. How is that impacting you, the threat of this and other railroads?
Yeah, Adam, I'm so pleased you asked about it. So this forced open access is kind of similar to if you had a McDonald's franchise on one side of a road have the access to the grill at the Burger King on the opposite side of the road whenever they want it. It really makes no sense in our economy. What it would do, practically speaking, in the railroad industry, current interchange is done at areas where we've invested significant amount of capital. We've got an agreement on where we're going to interchange cars, and it's done efficiently. If that gets blown up and opened up to wherever any customer would like to have that interchange occur, it puts interchange into places where there is no investment, where it's not efficient, and it damages the overall service product for our customer base. The worst thing about that, Adam, is right in the time where we're trying to put more on rail to resolve or at least help address global warming and greenhouse gas emissions, we'd retard the ability for the railroad to provide the service product that attracts traffic. And instead, it would start moving back over to highway and create more greenhouse gas emission. So it's just fundamentally not a sound idea.
Do you think that, and I want to be quick with this because there's something else I want to get that's fun to talk about, but do you think that this is going to stand, or do you think it's not going to actually happen?
I think it's been talked about for quite some time. President Biden isn't the first one to bring it up in his executive order. That topic has been in front of the Surface Transportation Board for years now, and it hasn't had action against it because it is a complex topic. There might be a way to get at some of what the STB is trying to satisfy in terms of the way they see the competitive dynamic, but largely speaking, open access mandated in the way it's been talked about to this point just doesn't make sense.
Lance, I want to switch to something fun because I think everybody is a little kid at heart, and who doesn't love running to the window when a train is going by and trying to guess the color of the caboose? But you have, an 80-year-old locomotive that rolled out again just recently. It was totally refurbished in 2019. This is, what do you call it, the Big Boy 4014? Tell me about this thing.
Yeah, the Big Boy is one of about 20 or 25 locomotives back in the day that we had built to handle the grades on a particular part of our railroad. They are the biggest steam locomotives ever produced in the world. And this one we refurbed. It is over 1 million pounds. Think about this. It weighs more than a fully loaded 747 with passengers and luggage. So we took it out to show our communities. We took it through 10 states. Over 34 days, traveled about 4,000 miles. And in some locations, we had crowds as big as 40 and 50,000 people. It's just a great ambassador that reminds the communities that we serve, all of our stakeholders, the grit, the ingenuity, the technology, and the sheer size and power of the freight railroad that we call Union Pacific. We're very, very proud of it.
Lance, when you said 1 million pounds, all I could think of is that's my current weight after almost 2 years doing this from home and eating too much. Lance Fritz is the president and CEO from Union Pacific. It is always good to see you. We look forward to seeing you in October when you report third quarter earnings. All the best to you and the team.